You're listening to the best of the Jason Rantz Show.
The Monologue.
We start with an exclusive story that tells you exactly how dire the situation has become in Seattle, all in relationship, I would argue, to the vaccine mandate, the one that went in place where if you are not going to comply with the vaccine mandate by either showing proof of vaccination or turning in, it's not even turning in a test. You either show it or you don't. And if you don't, or you're unvaccinated, or you're unwilling to send in your private medical data, you end up getting fired. Now, in Seattle, it's taken its toll on both the Seattle Police Department and the Seattle Fire Department. Both of these departments already struggling with staffing issues ended up getting hit even harder. And the real-world consequences of that happened last Tuesday. In two 911 calls, a 13-year-old Seattle boy pleaded for help as his father was suffering some kind of medical emergency in their apartment. But what would normally earn an immediate response was delayed, and the father died. First responders are now blaming the city's ongoing staffing crisis, which was worsened by the vaccine mandate. When Seattle Fire arrived, turns out they were told to wait before entering. Wait for police. Why? We'll tell you. I can tell you the teen first called 911 at 1:24 in the afternoon, and he said that his 45-year-old father was experiencing this crisis. Now, at the time, he wasn't sure what it was, but he clearly had a sense of panic in his voice.
Okay, how old is he?
Dad, grief. He's like 45.
Okay. Is he awake? Is he conscious?
I don't know. I think, he's conscious, but he's not okay.
Now you can hear it in his voice, the panic. And that obviously makes sense. A 13-year-old, anyone who's witnessing the person that they love in some sort of an emergency situation is going to feel panic. But he kept his cool. He clearly communicated during this 911 call, which I'll be honest, was difficult to listen to. But you heard him say, "Dad, breathe." He was struggling to breathe. Now, according to the incident report, it wasn't actually in the full 911 call because they pull out, they redact certain information that's private medical information of the patient. The incident report said that the teen had said that his father was, quote, making a moaning noise. That call comes in at 1:24. Now, just 2 minutes later, not even, the call gets dispatched to Seattle Fire at 1:26. That's when it happened. A medic unit normally would respond first, given what we now know. There are units staffed with two medics in a medic unit. Those are the ones who have the most medical experience. However, that day, I've confirmed that Seattle Fire was down one medic unit, again, due to the staffing crisis. Now, in fairness to Seattle Fire, they say the initial dispatch was for an aid response and that a medic on duty would not have been sent early on. Instead, they sent A18, that's Aid 18, that's the name of the unit. And it arrived within 5 to 6 minutes. Now, this is a unit that makes up of two firefighters. But when they got there, they weren't allowed to enter this apartment without officers being present. You see, when the 911 call came in, the dispatcher twice alerted Aid 18 and Seattle Fire that the resident at this property has a history of threats towards police and firefighters. And so the dispatcher instructed the firefighters that they must, quote, be accompanied by SPD to secure the scene. Now, this is what's known as a cautionary premise note. That's meant to provide information to Seattle Fire in order to keep them safe when entering any sort of residence or property. A18 drove around the block, and they staged, and they waited for SPD at approximately 1:32 p.m. They hit their on-scene button a few minutes later, according to this incident report. Now, as they were waiting, the teen calls 911 a second time. This was at 1:37 p.m. That's 13 minutes after the initial call. And he told the dispatcher that his father is getting worse. And you can hear a mix of panic in his voice, but almost the sound of someone knowing that things are dire and will not go well for the person he's looking at suffering and loves.
Look at his chest and tell me if it's rising and falling.
Barely.
Okay, is it
almost
moving?
Not at all.
So almost not at all or not at all?
Almost not at all. Almost.
In a medical emergency, every single second counts. But according to this incident report, a police unit wasn't even assigned to the incident until almost the time that this kid made the second call. That's 11 minutes after the dispatcher sent units to the residence. 11 minutes. And so Aid 18, or A18, they waited for about 7 minutes. And another call that team made sort of pushed them into decision mode. They decided, we're going to enter. The firefighters cautiously entered this apartment without any police at about 1:39 p.m. They started CPR the second they saw the father. About a minute after that, Engine 35, which comprises of 4 firefighters, they arrived. And then police showed up. In fact, police arrived on scene at 1:45 p.m. to begin to assist. At the same time, Medic 10, M10, that's a unit comprised of 2 medics, they arrived on the scene. Now, a source tells me that Seattle police ended up escorting that teenager to the apartment's lobby so he didn't have to see any more traumatic experiences. The others worked to save his dad's life, but unfortunately it would be too late. Despite working on the father for an hour, they weren't able to save him. Now, due to the privacy laws, as I said, the 911 calls redacted a lot of the details specific to the medical issue that the dad was facing, but 2 veteran medics familiar with this incident told me that this was likely avoidable. Not certainly avoidable, but likely avoidable. In fact, one medic I talked to told me that, quote, had it been addressed early, his chance of survival would have been 60%. The medic believes it was a ventricular fibrillation arrest. It's basically a heart attack, cardiac arrest, based on details that they learned from the case, and said it's very savable. In fact, if you look at a public health of Seattle and King County survey, they say 67% survival rate for anyone dealing with this kind of medical emergency if the first responders can get to the patient before cardiac arrest. Now, it wasn't just a staffing issue that delayed this response. There was an error that played a role in the outcome. Turns out that cautionary premise note, the one that said, you should wait, don't go in by yourself, it was outdated. They found out in the aftermath of what had happened that the cautionary note was attached to the address due to tenants that previously lived there, one tenant. Spokesperson with Seattle Fire tells me that the warning was for the apartment's previous tenant, because that tenant was known to be combative towards SFD and SPD, but the tenant moved out of the apartment recently, and this father, the victim, and his son recently moved in, so the cautionary note was never removed, because the system that they have in place only looks at it once every 2 years or so. Now, they've since upgraded that system to look at it more frequently. We don't know what that means. Now, in fairness, a process like this, a system like this, is never going to be perfect. There's always going to be some sort of hole in it. But that's why you have the mitigation efforts of having a cop show up. The prevailing opinion among Seattle Fire and SPD is that the current staffing crisis is to blame, that it wasn't the fault of the officers because they couldn't arrive to the scene on time or within a reasonable amount of time. I found out that they were down 2 officers at that moment, Second Watch, North Precinct, a precinct that has the highest rate, the longest rate of 911 response calls because they're so understaffed. This was a problem that was bad already, and it was made worse by Jenny Durkin. And as a result, we now have a kid who did everything right. He did everything he was supposed to do. He was supposed to call 911. He was supposed to do it immediately, calmly, clearly. And unfortunately, he ends up losing his dad. Now, I don't know the outcome if everything would have gone exactly as it was supposed to. We don't know that for certain. Of course, we can never know that. But we do know that we're in the middle of a staffing crisis, and I think it's reasonable to say we know that the father had a better shot at survival had everything gone the way it should have. You're listening to the best of the Jason Rantz Show.
The Monologue.
You remember how inflation was just a figment of our imaginations, that it wasn't actually real? Or let's quote our Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, it's transitory. It's not going to last forever, which is always kind of an interesting way to talk about inflation. I mean, correct, inflation doesn't always, you know, stay in perpetuity for years and years and years and years. It sometimes goes up and then it sometimes goes down. But, I mean, it was always a disingenuous way to talk about things. They made it sound like it would be done and over with in just a few months, maybe tops. But it seems clear that that's not happening and it's not going to happen. In fact, on CNN yesterday, there was an econ professor from Johns Hopkins University. His name is Steve Hanke, and he dismissed the claims that, oh, yeah, go ahead. You know what? Not only is inflation going to go away, but when you do the reconciliation bill with the Build Back Better infrastructure plan, oh, it's definitely going to help. It'll bring things down. He's all like, no.
This is utter rubbish, what you've just played. Inflation is always a monetary phenomenon. It's how much money the Federal Reserve and the commercial banking system is creating. And they've got so much money excess in the monetary bathtub right now that no matter what they do, if they completely cut the spigot off and didn't put anything in, we'd still have a big inflation problem that will last through 2024,
which from a political perspective, obviously that helps Republicans. And I say that not because I want to suffer until 2024, but I say that because it's a constant reminder of the situation we're in because of Biden's policies. Now, the Democrats can look at that too and say it's political, but react in a political way that would benefit us all, which is to pause on some of the spending, some of these plans that are making inflation worse. Now, is this econ professor 100% going to be accurate when it comes to 2024? Should we only listen to him? No, of course not. He could be off. He could be wrong, just like any expert can be. He's making a guess. It's a prediction. It's an informed prediction, but it's a prediction nevertheless. And I'm sure that the Biden administration will point to other economists who will say, oh, no, it's transitory, just like we said. But I think what's clear is that it's real. And I'm glad finally the administration is acknowledging it. And the longer it goes on, the more people suffer. And the only time maybe you can get Democrats to shift gears on some of these policies that are driven by their ideology is to make it political. No one's going to want to vote for a Democrat who's responsible for increasing the cost of pretty much every good that they go out and buy or service that they buy. The heat that they have in their home being higher now, it's not going to go. You can't blame Trump for that. You can't blame Trump. And you can dismiss it because you care about global warming. But the fact is, you can talk about climate change in a reasonable way, in a realistic way, in an honest way, while dismissing, without dismissing, the fact that people are hurting. Cecilia Vega over at ABC, she did a report today on how out of control inflation is getting.
Turn now to those skyrocketing prices across the country this morning. They are posing a new challenge for President Biden. He's set to sign his bipartisan infrastructure bill on Monday, but the inflation crisis is threatening his nearly $2 trillion spending plan, social spending plan, with some in his own party questioning whether more government spending is going to hurt Americans' bottom line even more. Our chief business correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis, has been tracking the latest. Rebecca, you are following these numbers so closely. Paychecks for millions of Americans not expected to go as far as they have in the past.
And then, of course, she gives the rap as to why that is. But that's the reality of the situation. And, you know, you've got Democrats saying it's important that we raise our hourly wages for these people so that they can live. Why are we paying a slave wage? Why are we making it so hard for these people to even get by, without, of course, saying they're the ones responsible for the increase in costs? And it does make me wonder, conspiratorial Jason going in, I'm wondering whether or not these people are trying almost to make inflation worse because they think it would then force these businesses to pay more to their employees. But even if you're going to give an employee a raise, let's say you gave them a 5% raise, well, that's not going to be enough to compete with a 6% jump in inflation. You can't operate like that. You can't operate like that. But let's be honest, at least no one has ever accused Democrats of understanding the economy or how to run a business.
The interview.
Well, if you live in Snohomish County, it's certainly possible that you're going to have a homeless hotel open up near your neighborhood. It looks especially promising for the city of Everett. Joining me on the line to discuss is our friend, Snohomish County Councilmember Sam Lowe. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
So the county has approved the a real estate firm, to go out and look for potential hotels that meet certain standards so that they could be turned into some kind of homeless shelter. You voted against this move, and you actually, along with Nate Nehring, another council member, tried to get it so that if the county decides that they do, in fact, want to purchase one of these hotels for the use of a homeless shelter, you actually have to do some sort of outreach. That failed, unfortunately. So tell us the situation.
Well, you know, Jason, to me, this is about 100% about transparency and accountability to the public. And I put forward an amendment to say, hey, before the county buys a hotel in any city, including Everett, and Everett's the city I grew up in, so I know it really, really well, let the elected officials know, let the public know. And that amendment failed 3-2. And so some council members saw the Everett City Council members saw the article in the Everett Herald, reached out to me, said, what's going on here? They weren't even aware that the county was looking to buy a hotel in their city, and they're the elected officials, which is exactly why I wanted my amendment to go forward.
Well, and it's they work with certain people, because in that Everett Herald story that you mentioned, the spokesperson for Mayor Cassie Franklin is quoted in there. So the mayor's office knew, but the council somehow didn't.
Yeah, apparently they didn't. I know they talked about a letter Wednesday night at their city council meeting. I know that it's going to come up next Wednesday as that letter is formalized. And I understand it's a letter that they're going to send to the county saying, hey, where's our voice in this? Because they are the voice for their constituents. And I think cities should have a voice in this process.
Of course. And the reason why you hide it, the reason why you don't want their voice, is because you know what they're going to say, which is they might say, hey, no, we don't necessarily want this. Or why don't we do things slightly different, since we actually live here and we're the ones who are impacted, not the ones who are making this vote. So where do you think things will go now that a giant spotlight has been provided?
Well, I know that they want to buy these hotels in every county council district. I mean, that's the bigger plan.
That's ultimately what they, yeah.
Yeah, this is just the first step. And if they can sneak this one through, then they can just do dominoes with the rest. And I think it's important that a light is shown on this. You know, there's a lot of other costs associated with this. I mean, the ARPA funding, the COVID relief funding is what's paying for these hotels in King County and now Snohomish County. But what about the maintenance and the upkeep and all the other things, the roof repairs that the taxpayer are going to have to pay for after this COVID money dries up?
Yeah, exactly. No one seems to care about that. They seem more interested in just getting this project funded initially, because they know that once you create a project and you fund it, it just doesn't go away. The homeless hotel will never be shut down, regardless, by the way, of any results that come out of it. It could be a huge disaster and it stays there forever. Like you said, the goal is to bring this across the county. When you put in this amendment just to merely, and by the way, this is incredibly reasonable, just to give the voice to the people, what did the Democrats on the council tell you?
We know the county council member who represents the community I grew up in Everett, I think she looks at Kasama Sawan as a hero and a trailblazer. And that council member is the one who led the effort, and she represents Everett. She led the effort to defeat my amendment for transparency and accountability for the city of Everett and for the people who live in Everett with this hotel purchase. So it's crazy.
Unbelievable. So last question for you. Are you against the idea itself, or are you against the idea with it not being presented to the people to vote or to, you know, have a say?
Well, to me, it comes down to the core of county government, which to me is public safety, elections, you know, courts. And now it looks like a new core of county government is going to be the hotel business.
Mm-hmm.
And the hotel business with zero public input. So I don't think the county should be in the hotel business. I mean, we've partnered with Housing Hope. We've partnered with Cocoon House. We've partnered with a lot of different religious organizations to provide housing opportunities and homeless housing. And now we're just throwing, seems like we're throwing that model out the door and going to this King County, Seattle model of buying hotels. And I do have a problem with that.
Yeah, like we say on the show every single day, bad ideas out of Seattle tend to spread, and there's no escaping it unless you push back. And that's why elections have consequences. And unfortunately, folks couldn't put Brenda Carrington in a position on the council. And here's a result of that. Snohomish County Councilmember Sam Lowe, as always, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason. Have a great day.
You as well. You are listening to the best of the Jason Rand Show on this Thanksgiving week. Happy Thanksgiving.
The Jason Rand Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rand.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rand, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
For only the next few days, Kim Wyman will remain the Washington State Secretary of State before she moves on to the Biden administration working on cybersecurity and elections. She joins us on the line now to explain the decision. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
The big question is, of course, you were just reelected, and obviously Republicans put a lot of money on you, sometimes literally, and making sure that you had won. Also, we can keep the seat away from a Republican. And then this news came as a bit of a shock to the party. So take us through your decision.
Yes. You know, when I got into the public sector and, 40 years ago, actually, it was about service. And it was trying to serve my community and serve my state. And now it's a chance to serve at the national level. Our elections are the cornerstone of democracy, and I'm in a position because of my experience in Washington as Secretary of State and as auditor and as election director to help some of the best cyber minds in the country protect that system from foreign adversaries like Russia and China and Iran. And I am uniquely qualified for this position and can help, and I want to serve my country.
Did they come to you or did you go to them?
They came to me.
And when they made the pitch, how did it go?
Well, the actual person that I spoke with was the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Jen Easterly. And, this is a chance to defend the Constitution. This is a chance to, make sure that our country's elections are believed by people and are protected from bad actors. And, she said, do you want to serve your country? And absolutely.
When you were thinking about this decision, obviously it's a big move, right? You're leaving the state. You're going to be serving for an administration for hopefully only a few years, and then you'll keep the job. But with a new administration, you don't have to comment on that because it'll get you in trouble. But I'm the talk show host. I get to. What went through your mind as far as some of the unintended consequences here in Washington?
Well, all of them. Not finishing my term was something that I was concerned about because I'd made a commitment to my supporters. Certainly the fact that my position would be appointed by the governor and I'd have no control in who would be my successor. But, I hope that my supporters sometime in the future, if not now, will see that their investment in me to help me become Secretary of State has paid off and now will help us secure our national elections. Because all of the experience I've had in the last 28 years here in Washington State has prepared me for this moment. And it is a unique position I find myself in because of my local and state experience. There really aren't many election officials who've served. And, there are times in your life where everything has prepared you for that moment and you're ready. And this is one of those times. And that call to duty is really important to me.
What was the reaction like from just members of the public, your supporters?
It's been overwhelmingly positive, and people are just very happy for me, and happy that I'll be serving at that federal level. Certainly, there's been some detractors, and there are people that I'm sure on social media are saying all sorts of nasty things, and I'm just not choosing to read them.
Well, that's definitely just Twitter. Just don't go on Twitter ever about any
okay,
topic or
ever.
Any person. Yeah. Period. So don't think that they're picking on you specifically. So obviously there are political ramifications to this, and you're very clearly a nonpartisan. You're a Republican, but you're not a partisan mm-hmm. in that position at all. You've been mm-hmm. hit though by criticisms, but from folks on the right, claiming that you are more of a Democrat than you're leading on, or at least more of a moderate than you're leading on. This plays into that. What is your response to that?
Jason, I've been doing this for 20 years now, and during that entire 20-year period, I've been accused of being a whole lot of things, from a rhino Republican in name only, to a Democrat, to a right-wing conservative, to a Trumpster, to a left-wing liberal. So, people are going to write the narrative that they mm-hmm. want in who I am and what my party affiliation is and all that. And what I know is 40 years ago, Ronald Reagan inspired me by his principles, and I've ascribed to him my entire adult life, and that's what has always made me a Republican and continues to this day.
Secretary of State Kim Wyman joining me on the line. She's discussing her decision to leave her post here to take on a bigger post and more responsibilities on the national level. Did they have any conversations with you about the fact that you're a Republican?
Certainly, they. Certainly that was the literal elephant in the room. But I think that's another thing that gives me pride and gives me hope about. Certainly the president's support of this position and this appointment is that he chose a Republican. And I think in doing that, it's to send a message that elections are important to every American, regardless of your party status, and that this is going to be approached in a nonpartisan manner.
That's true. Although, and you and I have talked about this on air quite a few times, Democrats are pushing for a complete overhaul of the election with H.R. 2. And you spoke out strongly against that. That's in conflict, obviously, with the president's position and the party's position in power. Number one, do you think that that is still an unwise idea? And number two, how would you navigate any kind of issue like that when voting rights are being discussed in bigger ways and elections could potentially be changed?
Well, I think the strength of our system is that the Constitution is very clear that elections are the responsibility of the states. And I think we will always go back to that as a country, no matter what Congress wants to do either way. And I have faith in the Constitution, and I believe that that will always prevail over the long run. In my new role, of course, I will not be a policy person any longer. I won't be making or setting policy, but I also believe that we have a lot of people on the left and the right who are going to advocate for election changes and reform for the rest of time, and that's a good, healthy discussion for us as Americans. So I am optimistic that we're going to be okay.
So the Seattle Times decided to hit you on the way out. They hit you with this ridiculous editorial slamming you for not mandating that your employees either show their vaccination card proving that they're vaccinated or get the vaccine and showing you their card. You ordered them back to work anyway. It's my understanding that there were massive surges of COVID all throughout the state because of your decision, or at least that's how it read from the Seattle Times, which should be noted that the Seattle Times doesn't have a vaccine mandate in place, at least as of this moment. So what is your response to that?
Well, when you make policy decisions and you get to sit in the big chair, I have to make a policy decision I can live with. And putting everything down to its core elements, I have to live with the idea that, if I force people to choose between working or getting a vaccine, I want to make sure that's going to be a good decision. And, we don't know what the long-term effects of these vaccines are. No one does because they haven't been around long enough. So no one knows what the impact is going to be 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road. And I can't live with the idea that I could force someone to take an action that could harm them potentially. So I'm going to go ahead and just stay with our, until I leave office in a week and day or so. I'm going to go ahead and have our people continue to work the way they have been, and the new secretary can decide what they want to do because it'll be their job.
And there you go. Secretary of State Kim Wyman, we're going to miss you on the show. You are a friend, a show regular. On top of that, you've been always open and easy to work with, which is not always the case for elected officials. So we wish you the best of luck, and certainly we expect that you will send us plenty of leaks from the national level so that I can further my career. Kim Wyman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show. Now this. You're listening to the best of The Jason Rantz Show. There's no doubt that crime in Seattle is going to continue to worsen before it gets better. It doesn't matter that we pick up one seat on the council and we were able to push away Nicole Thomas Kennedy, the police abolitionist. That is undoubtedly good things for the city. But those are, in a way, long-term investments. They're not short-term investments. You're not going to see a return on your investment immediately because you still have a council that is overwhelmingly anti-police. You have a council that just put out a budget that, in fact, cuts police. That obviously is the wrong direction for this city. And as a result, there are still so many people who are suffering with all of this. Matthew Humphrey, for example, is the owner of Steel Barber in Ballard, in Seattle. And he was on with the Dory Monson show yesterday. And he noted how the situation is just getting worse. And this is a community, this is a neighborhood that has really been hit hard by homelessness. I know we spend a lot of time focusing like on Pioneer Square in downtown Seattle, mostly because Ballard is so out of the way. You kind of forget it's there. But the homeless haven't. They seem to be flocking there.
It's gotten progressively worse. We're finding in the last couple months since the weather's changed, we've had more issues with, you know, the drug addicted, mentally ill campers all around us coming in, harassing my team. We've had more break-ins up the street in this last month. I did a quick count on Facebook, and there's at least 17 other businesses all within a couple block radius of me that have been either vandalized or broken into. So it's just getting worse before it gets better.
That's going to be the future for Seattle, to be clear. Unfortunately, that's going to be the future. It gets worse before it gets better. And that, of course, is only contingent. It getting better is only contingent on whether or not people will take the momentum in this last election and hang on to it. Because remember, in Seattle, you're not voting on these council members next year. You've got until 2023. But the midterm elections nationally will hopefully give us some momentum here in Washington state. Whereas maybe Seattle keeps putting the same people in the state legislature, but everyone around us, maybe they make a change and they take away the Seattle influence. And when you take away the Seattle influence, they start feeling the pressure and they will start to moderate maybe just a little bit. People have to really, really, really get upset. And we can't allow one election that could be written off as an anomaly with NTK and Nikita Oliver, the other abolitionists, losing their races. That could be written off as an anomaly. This is Seattle. We know that at its core, it's deeply, deeply, deeply left-leaning to fringe. And people have to get sick of this enough that they step up and do something. Matthew doesn't want to move out. He doesn't want to change locations. He likes it where it is. But he does want the city to actually do well by the taxpayers and the businesses.
We have what I consider the best street in the whole city with restaurants and retail. It looks like a movie set. It's this amazing place. And we built out this amazing shop. And, you know, by all rights, I keep adding to the payroll and hiring more people and paying in the tax base. And what's really unfortunate is I'm not getting the basic security that I'd expect in a city like this. And, you know, they've taken so much away, but they haven't replaced it with anything else. So we've been working closely with the Ballard Alliance on coming up with our own security plan and our own security guards, because I just can't, to your point, take the emotional toll much less bear the financial burden of the continual crime that's happening.
Is anything he's saying inappropriate, unreasonable, over the top, too much, even by Seattle standards? No, of course not. Of course not. What he's asking for is perfectly normal and reasonable, and anyone would make this ask. Anyone would make this ask. The issue that he has is he's just trying to survive here. He's just trying to do well by his customers and his employees, and of course his own business, which is getting harder and harder to maintain because insurance isn't willing to help businesses when they get hit with crime in certain scenarios.
I used my insurance to pay for the glass door and the theft, and they promptly canceled me. So now I'm reluctant to even use my insurance to pay for the store, which is going to end up costing me about $4,000. So I really have nowhere to turn other than my shrinking bottom line from COVID.
It's remarkable. So they break through his glass door. What is the message here? You can't have glass windows or doors. You better have them boarded up and just have a sign that says open and hope people come in. I mean, that is almost the reality of doing business in Seattle. And I don't see it ever changing unless people really, really start to push back in meaningful ways. And we started to see it happen in this last election, but it's not going to be enough. You're going to have to continue to move past that. You're going to have to continue with the momentum, and you're going to have to do a little bit more each and every day to ensure that we bring some semblance of sanity back into this city.
The Last Rants.
And with that, there's something related, actually, that I want to talk about. I'm really annoyed with. In fact, any of you who follow me on Instagram, you probably see my stories complaining about this one thing that happens pretty frequently. In fact, on Instagram, if you want to follow me, it's under Jason Rants, JSONRANTZ. I take the bus to work because I want to humble myself by not having a car. And I just don't want a car. I don't need a car right now. I would rather not have to pay $300 for parking every single month on top of the insurance and all of the gas. So I don't want anything to do with it. And I'm in a position where it works for me right now. How long it works for me, don't know. But I go to the bus stop every day. And it's near it's not a homeless encampment, it's an overnight stay. And it's somewhat, the bus stop is on the opposite side of the same street. So if you were to go around the block, for example, it's halfway there. And there is a trash bin there that is never actually full, or at least I've never seen it full, or if I have, maybe once or twice. It's frequently not full. Which is an important point because there's always a piece of trash on top of it. It's usually a coffee cup. Sometimes it's something else, but it's nothing that can't actually fit into the trash bin. People are putting their trash on top of or around the trash bin that is empty. It takes a special kind of laziness to actually get away with that. It truly does. To think that that's okay. And I suspect it's homeless people. Can't prove it. I suspect it's homeless people because homeless people are always camped out at that one particular bus stop, and there's trash everywhere most of the time. If it's not homeless people, then it's just your everyday citizen who, I fear, looks around this city, looks at what it's become, and says, you know what? Whatever. It's not that big of a deal. The city already looks like a dumpster. Might as well just put my trash on top of the trash bin. It's not just annoying, it's disrespectful to the city. But when I think about it and I realize how many people are so disrespectful to the city on a regular basis, whether it's an inability to put trash in a trash bin or an inability to follow basic laws, I can't say that I'm shocked. And that's a sad state of affairs. And that's the last rant.